Welcome to a Thursday edition of What Matters in North Carolina. My name is Mark Shiver. Glad to have you listening to the program today. We've got a lot in store for you. We'll be talking with our friend Nick Oxner. He's the investigative reporter for WBTV in Charlotte, always into something, and we'll find out what today. I can tell you that it has to do with veterans and healthcare, so you know it's not likely to be a real upbeat, happy story, but Nick is on the job, and hopefully things will get better as a result of the work that he has been doing there investigating what's been going on at the Salisbury VA Medical Center. And I am so excited. For the very first time, Senator Joyce Kravick is going to be our guest today. And I always am excited when we widen the net, as I call it, and more members of the North Carolina General Assembly are guests on the program. And we've developed a really good relationship with the members of the General Assembly. Speaker Moore, as you know, is a good friend of the program, Senator Berger. And we just find that it's good folks to talk to, and they always have something interesting to say and informative, and typically not all talking points. And we're glad to have another member of the General Assembly as a guest on our show. Senator Joyce Kravick will be stopping by in just a few minutes. And then I'll be talking with the host of NC Gundad, Matt Coulter, also our great producer. Matt is going to talk about some audio that we found. It's a year old, but it's still compelling. Hillary Clinton railing against the NRA, railing against the Second Amendment, and going off. And so since Matt is the NC Gundad, we'll get his thoughts on that. And the very real attacks that are occurring, not just on our Second Amendment, but also on our First Amendment, freedom of speech, freedom of religion, and all of that. Well, it's good to know that NBC has a completely unbiased reporter on the scenes. This guy, Ron Allen, thinks that the climate deal that was signed, it cleared its final hurdle yesterday. The European Union and 10 nations submitted their final official ratification. And so now Mr. Allen, who is obviously, you know, he's a journalist, so he's not biased. News only, he thinks that the climate deal is going to stop storms like Hurricane Matthew. And of course, he added in his report that it's why it's so important to President Obama's legacy that Hillary Clinton follow him, because Donald Trump might not abide by the Paris Treaty for climate change. Anyway, I hope that the United States will ignore this treaty, because it is absolutely absurd. We're going to get into that in the days ahead, because I'm very passionate about this issue, and it's time that people got some sense when it came to this whole climate change thing and global warming and carbon taxes and this targeted attack once again on American business and American sovereignty. So before I get wound up, we're going to move right along. Remind you that you can download the show anytime at freedomactionnetwork.com. You can find What Matters in North Carolina in the iTunes and Google Play stores. Please tell your friends and family and get them involved in listening to What Matters in North Carolina also. It's always a pleasure to talk with folks from the North Carolina General Assembly, and this morning we're going to have a delightful conversation, I'm sure, with Senator Joyce Kravick. She represents the fine folks in Forsyth and Yadkin County. And Senator, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. I'm happy to be with you. Thank you for having me.
Well, I had the pleasure of being on a panel with you a couple of weeks ago where we were talking about what it means to be a conservative today. Mm-hmm. And out of that, got a chance to talk to you afterwards, and I appreciate you accepting our invitation to be on the show. But can you kind of summarize from your point of view, particularly as a lawmaker, what does it mean to you to be a conservative here in 2016?
Well, being a conservative is really, it's a lot more difficult than being a liberal, because liberals oftentimes just say yes to everybody, and then they can point the finger if things don't work. And somebody asked me one time, what is a conservative? What are you trying to conserve? I said, freedom and liberty, because that's what our country was founded upon, and it's the basis for who we are as a country. And being a conservative sometimes means saying no, because government doesn't work very well. And those of us in government particularly see it, if we want to. But most folks, I think, understand that the private sector does almost everything better than the government, other than our military. We don't have anything that functions as it does in the private sector. And I think being a conservative is difficult because you have to point those things out. You have to say no to growing government, and you have lots of folks wanting it to grow bigger and bigger, to take more and more of your money. And that's just not the way it's supposed to work. Our tax code is completely out of control. As you know, and I'm sure most of your listeners know, we have a debt that's going to cripple our grandchildren, and we're just headed down the wrong path. So conservatism works every time it's tried. Socialism, liberalism, whatever you want to call it, has never worked. And as conservatives, we look to the past because it proves that what we believe works. And liberals always look to the future. You know, it just didn't work because we didn't have enough money. The future cannot disprove their theories. And so they're always looking to the future. It's going to be better if I'm in control and if I hold the purse strings and if I spend the money. And conservatives know that's not the case. People need to be free to pursue their own dreams and their own happiness, and it makes our country work.
Well, Senator, that just makes a whole lot of sense to me. And I scratch my head at times that there are actually people who don't agree or believe what you just said. And I find it remarkable that people, you know, don't mind having the government control a large part of their lives. They don't mind the government taking, you know, their hard-earned money. It's pretty bizarre to me to think about.
It really is, and I think part of the problem we hear about the rich not paying their fair share, which is completely untrue, as you and I know, but 50%, if you divided the country 50% of the top income earners and 50% of the bottom income earners, that top 50% pays 98% of the taxes.
Wow.
So half the folks virtually are paying nothing. So they don't care how high the tax rate goes. Why
yeah.
should they? It doesn't cost them anything. Actually, it's more benefits for them. And we're getting to a very dangerous tipping point because if you read the book Atlas Shrugged or saw the movie, you know there's a time where, you know, Atlas just shrugs and people say, you know, why bother?
Yeah. Well, our guest, Senator Joyce Krawczyk from the district representing Forsyth and Yadkin counties, doing an excellent job. And I was going to change the subject, but I just feel like we need to hit that one more time. In terms of people in North Carolina, I think fall into a category of having a history of having been the, you know, good old Southern Democrats, which had really a conservative worldview back in the day. But
right.
They still identify, I think, locally in some respects as Democrats, but the National Party has gotten so extremely liberal. And yet, I don't know. I just can't believe, like, for example, House Bill 2. I can't believe that, anybody in North Carolina, except maybe for a few progressives that have moved here from other states, would actually be opposed to common sense protecting of women and children. These things are just, I don't know. They make
yeah.
me scratch my head.
They're mind-boggling because our common sense tells us that men should not be allowed to go in the bathroom with women and little girls. And I hate to pick on men, but, you know, most of the sexual predators are men. So that's just common sense, and it's a fact. And we, as conservatives, we look to the facts. You know, we believe that facts matter, and liberals don't. They believe that you can change the facts to suit whatever issue it is that you're relying on. And so they'll throw out, you know, well, there aren't any transgender people who are sexual molesters. That's not what it's about. It's for those people who would pretend to be transgenders, because they are sexual predators. And it opens the door wide open for them.
Exactly.
And I don't understand the common sense logic that people don't understand. But the biggest thing about HB 2 was that Charlotte did not have the authority to do what they did. Since 1835, you know, our Constitution has laid out how North Carolina is to be governed, and local governments do not have the authority to make laws or resolutions or ordinances or whatever they want to call them on business. And they've way overstepped their bounds, and they've done it before. We've seen it with, you know, privilege taxes and things like that that we've tried to roll back.
Right.
But this time they really overstepped their bounds by demanding that all business convert to this bathroom ordinance.
Right.
And they don't have the authority to do that. We want uniform codes across North Carolina so that businesses know what the code is in Charlotte and they know what it is in Winston-Salem. And I think we've allowed those local governments to do far more than they ever had the authority to do. And so now it's like peeling back an onion. It's really ugly when it starts happening.
Well, what's interesting to me, Senator, is that we really don't hear what you just said a lot in the debate, that constitutionally Charlotte had overstepped their bounds. I think that that's something that certainly the left doesn't want to be talking about, because they want to focus on their agenda of changing everything. One of the things that really was revealing to me was over in the House, Representative Segro, who, by the way, I can't understand why he's still the executive director of Equality NC, and there's got to be some conflict of interest there, but he drafted a bill that, of course, never went anywhere, but in it, he had all of this language about discrimination and equality and all this and that, and it was striking to me, Senator, that he had lined through the words birth gender or birth sex with identity, and there's so much more at stake here than who goes to the bathroom where. They
That's
want
right.
to change the fundamental foundations of the world as we know it. And to me, that's downright scary.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. And the bill that we passed, HB 2, you know, it stated very clearly that you should make accommodations for those few people. And there are very few actual transgender people.
Right.
So you're changing the whole thing. Lieutenant Governor Dan Forrest has the best example. He said when the Americans with Disability Act came about, we did not require that all business make all of their parking lot handicapped spaces. It just said make special allowances for those handicapped people.
Right.
And you have to have so many handicapped spaces for them. Well, that's a reasonable accommodation. But demanding that all of your bathrooms be open and be not even be have any sexual identities on them at all is just ludicrous. Special accommodations would have been a reasonable thing to do for those people that actually needed it, and it's a very small number of people. You don't change everything for a small minority of people. It just doesn't make any common sense.
Well, you know, Senator, the NCAA and the Atlantic Coast Conference have moved championship games out of the state. What's really funny is that they moved the championship football game to Florida, which, you know, doesn't have any special protections for transgender people. So there seems to be some kind of hypocrisy here. But I really strongly believe, and I don't want to sound conspiratorial, but I believe all of this was thought out beforehand in an attempt to really harm not only Governor McCrory, but the Republicans in general across the state.
Yes, absolutely. It was a political ploy from the beginning. We know that Mayor Jennifer Roberts coordinated with the Human Rights Campaign. We know that Roy Cooper was involved in those discussions. It was all orchestrated to make our state look bad. And to have ordinary people, they always muddy the water. So ordinary citizens don't always know the true facts of everything. You know,
yeah.
It paint us as discriminatory, which we are absolutely not. And but, you know, to a certain extent, it worked. We got a lot of national attention, which was not good. But I think they are misjudging the North Carolina citizens, because I can tell you the folks in my district were almost standing on the street corner shouting when there was a conversation that we might be looking to repeal it or to adjust it somewhat. make changes. They were saying, don't dare, don't dare. That would just be the nose under the camel's tent. And we did, you know, throw out the olive branch to the mayor of Charlotte. If they would repeal the ordinance, we would discuss, if they would repeal the ordinance, then we would discuss repealing the bill. And, of course, they weren't willing to do that because, there again, it would take away the issue, and the issue is what they want.
Exactly. Our guest is very articulate and very effective, Senator Joyce Kravic. And, Senator, some of the things that have been accomplished over the past several years in the General Assembly are quite remarkable. The debt that the Republican majority was facing when they assumed leadership in the majority in the January of 2011, the horrible state that the unemployment division was in, the state health plan, we don't hear much about that, but I was working down there and I knew that firsthand that it was in great disarray. And you guys have really accomplished a lot, haven't you?
Oh, yeah. We have done some really good stuff, and it's too bad that it gets clouded out with the liberals shouting about the things that they disagree with. But, yeah, we paid off a $2.8 billion debt to the federal government. And if Democrats had stayed in control, that would still be going up, and we would probably owe $5 billion by now because they didn't want to make any adjustments at all. We had the most liberal unemployment insurance program in the country. And folks were making more unemployed than they were when they were employed with the system that the Democrats had set up. And it was completely unsustainable. And so when we came in, we worked out a program to pay it off. And I think that the target was 6 years, but we paid it off in 2.5 years, 30 months. Every penny was paid off, and I credit Dale Falwell for that, who is running for the treasurer, North Carolina treasurer. I hope he succeeds because he was instrumental in getting that done.
Yes.
And folks just don't know about those things. And in addition to that, we've replenished the rainy day fund that the Democrats raided and raided and raided. We gave teachers the biggest raise in the history of North Carolina, which facts show that, but there again, the other side wants to cloudy that and say it didn't happen, but it did happen. So I just encourage folks to get the facts and, don't listen to anybody. Get your facts and search them out and find out what the truth is. And I know that's difficult. And what I do, because it's even hard for me, and I'm down there, I find my most valuable resource is Civitas and the Locke Foundation for peeling through all of the fog and telling me this is exactly what this does. And that is so helpful because we just don't have the time always to do it. We have a small staff, and those bills are long. And when you read them, then you wonder what they said after you read them. Some parts you get, but it's so helpful to have somebody that you can trust, like Civitas and Locke, that can help us understand those things. And I would just encourage all of your listeners to go to those resources and get the facts.
Well, I appreciate you saying that because we really do try to separate the fact from fiction and just try to clarify things as they come along. So we really appreciate that encouragement. I know that you have work to do there in the district. I always like to ask, Senator, when I have folks from the General Assembly on, you represent two counties there, and you have lots of constituents, and I know that they call and they email. I know that you get around and you
yes,
visit.
Yes, they do.
you get around and you visit with them. Tell me how the people in Forsyth and Yadkin County are feeling. Are they upbeat? Are they fearful? Are they anxious? Are they excited? What's the mood like in your district these days?
I think most of them are upbeat and excited, but at the same time, they do worry. I mean, we have an election coming up that's very markedly different candidates, and I think folks are a little concerned that, we've got a $20 trillion debt and no end in sight, if Hillary Clinton is elected. And yeah, I think they're worried. I think they're worried about it. But at the same time, they are excited. Many of them are working really hard. And of course, you know, all of my folks are not conservative in my district. I represent some liberals as well, but not as many. I'm honored to represent the 31st District, by the way. It's a wonderful district, and I love visiting with my constituents. I love being able to help them. That's one of the best parts of this job, is being able to help folks get through the maze of state government with whatever issue they have. We've got a lot of road building going on in Forsyth County, so I probably get more complaints that I have to deal with regarding DOT than anything else. And oftentimes, it shouldn't be this way, and I've said it over and over, folks should not have to call their senator to get something done. They should be able to go to that agency and get it done. But oftentimes, they've been, you know, working through that maze for sometimes months. And, you know, if I'm able to make a few phone calls, send a few emails, talk to the right people, I can usually get it resolved to some degree. And that is very rewarding, to be able to help those folks who have problems in the district.
Absolutely. Well, I know you're doing a fine job representing the folks in your district and across the state. Senator Kravick, thank you very much for your time today. We hope to have
you on
in the near future. Once again, you're an excellent guest, and we appreciate you joining us here on What Matters in North Carolina.
Thanks so much, Mark. I appreciate it. Take care. Bye-bye.
Yes, ma'am. You too. Bye-bye. We look forward every couple of weeks to chatting with our good friend Nick Oxner. He's an investigative reporter, does a fine job for WBTV in Charlotte. Nick, welcome back to What Matters in North Carolina.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I was reading a story that you posted a couple of days ago about the VA Medical Center in Salisbury, and the only way I can describe it is it sounds like quite a mess.
I think that'd be a pretty accurate description. I wouldn't argue with you on that.
Well, tell us a little bit about some employees manipulating wait time data.
Yeah, so there was a new report, an investigative summary report issued by the Office of the Inspector General for the Department of Veteran Affairs based in Washington. It was issued Tuesday night. And what the investigation found is that employees at the Salisbury VA were manipulating patient wait time data at the direction of their supervisors so that it made it look as though patients were being seen within a two-week window.
Wow. Well, that apparently was not the case. Do you have any idea what the real wait time was?
Well, we have some ideas in some instances, because what is released publicly is a summary of the investigation, but specifically what they found, so the VA has this standard that veterans should be seen within 14 days of their preferred appointment date.
Okay? Right.
But that's hard, and that's, this is in the aftermath of the long wait times being exposed and what happened. So this is the period that the investigation looked at was late April 2014 through March of 2015. All right, so this is after the first round of first revelations that there were long, excessive wait times at VA departments. So there was a standard that patients needed to be seen within 14 days of their preferred appointment date.
Okay.
And that was to make sure that veterans were getting, you know, immediate or, you know, quick access to care. And so some supervisors, hospital administrators, the director of the Salisbury VA, her boss, the regional director of the VA, all had metrics in their performance review plans that measured, or that, you know, took into consideration the percentage of veterans that were being seen within 14 days. And so what this investigation found is that supervisors were telling employees to manipulate the data to make it look as though their appointments were within 14 days of their preferred date. And they were doing this specifically so that it looked as though virtually every veteran in Salisbury was being seen within 14 days.
Well, I could imagine that certainly is not the case. Now, I'm reading your story here online. Apparently, at one point, there were people with waiting periods of over a year, 500 days. That seems excessive.
That, That's correct. And according to this investigation, that was in the women's health clinic where schedulers there, actually, because there were so many people who needed appointments and just not enough appointments available, they weren't even actually scheduling appointments for veterans. They were just keeping a secret list of veterans who needed to have appointments scheduled. And some of those veterans were waiting 500 days for their appointments that hadn't actually been scheduled. And this, again, is to manipulate the numbers. You know, another employee said that she was told to fluff the numbers. Another employee told investigators that they were told to, that they were counseled, in a sense, or disciplined, reprimanded, for scheduling actual appointments, you know, when appointments were available, and for not manipulating the numbers. Now, the other troubling thing here, Mark, is that, one, the director of the Salisbury VA has refused to answer any questions about this, Kay Green. She put out a press release last night that roughly mirrored the interview and the comments that she made to investigators based on what investigators wrote in their summary. But she seems to say, well, she does say, that two things. One, she says that in response to what they've uncovered, she's hiring two new people to go in and audit appointments and wait times as a result of this investigation. But two, she says that they were already self-auditing and reviewing wait time data as far back as 2013, a year before, right after she got there as director, but a year before investigators began looking at this. Now, that raises a lot of questions as to what they were actually looking at or what they actually found, because Kay Green told investigators that she had been auditing and the Salisbury VA had been auditing itself for a year and they hadn't found anything. But when auditors looked at a two-day span of appointments, they wrote in their investigative summary that they found a suspiciously large number of appointments with zero-day wait times that had been manipulated. So it really begs the question then, what were they actually auditing? What did that audit actually find? And were they doing anything at all?
Wow. You know, this is not a news question, but just an observation. And our guest is Nick Oxner from WBTV in Charlotte. Nick, it seems like you never really hear anything positive when it comes to the Veterans Administration and healthcare. There's this aura surrounding that whole thing that these veterans are having to wait lengthy times. The care is often not what we would have come to expect for people who have, well, for anybody, but particularly those who have served our country. So assuming what I just said is true, that there are challenges in the delivery of healthcare for veterans, what do you think the deal is? Are there just too many of them? Do people not care? Is it just too bloated with bureaucracy?
It would appear, well, I mean, I think it's indisputable that there are, in the post-9/11 world that we live in, there are a large number of veterans, an increasingly large number of veterans returning from combat, and those veterans require attention. And me, I say that, you know, as a Gold Star son of a soldier who lived at Fort Bragg for 18 years. Mm-hmm. And so veterans returning from combat have undoubtedly increased the demand for services that the VA provides. And you partner that with a VA system that is still doing things on paper, for instance, that still hasn't transformed into an all-digital filing system, that is, you know, the VA would argue, is underfunded, that did not have the infrastructure in place to handle the increased demand that it has seen over the last decade. So you have these new veterans that are coming back that need additional care. You have, you know, Vietnam and Gulf War era veterans who still require care. And I think the VA, to a large part, is, you know, overextended beyond what it is capable of providing. Now, that doesn't mean that, you know, they don't have a duty to provide that care, or alternatively, you know, that's why it is so egregious when we hear stories like this one and we see investigative findings like this one, that instead of owning up to the problem and being realistic and providing, you know, an actual honest metric so that administrators can recognize the problem, instead, what we've seen from this report, from other reports over the last 3 or 4 years, is that employees were hiding the amount of backlog that they have and the problems that they're having. And so that it's, you know, has been nearly impossible, but for years of investigating, to recognize the full extent to which the VA is, you know, overwhelmed.
Yeah, it's really problematic. And oftentimes, I know that people have to call their congressman or their senator to try to cut through the red tape, but it's really kind of, you know, really not right, I guess is the only way to put it, when you think about the veterans that have served our country and to be treated in less than, you know, efficient manner is certainly disconcerting. But I've noticed that you touched on this, but the director of the Salisbury Medical Center apparently refusing to answer your questions about this manipulation of wait times?
Refusing to give one explanation for this outside of a press release that she put out last night at 6:30. That's roughly 24 hours after the report was released. We broke the news of this new investigative report Tuesday night on our 11 o'clock news. We reached out for a comment to her PR staff 11 o'clock at night, asking for a comment and explaining to them that we were going to do another story the next day. That was yesterday. And requesting a comment. We sent multiple emails to them requesting an interview, looking for answers. They didn't respond. They didn't reply. They didn't say, no, we're not going to talk to you. They said absolutely nothing. And so, which is consistent with how they've, I don't want to say responded because they haven't, which is consistent with how they've handled our inquiries over the last 8 months since we've been investigating issues related to the Salisbury VA. And so we decided that because of the nature of the findings of the investigative report, that this is something, you know, we probably talked about this before, Mark, but some of the stories and investigations that we do require people in power to be held accountable and to answer for the things that have been uncovered. And we felt that Kay Green, the director of the Salisbury VA, owes veterans an answer for why patient wait time data was being manipulated. And we felt that she needed to be held accountable and to explain that. And so far, she has absolutely refused to provide the public one answer about this, outside of a written statement, which she said they're hiring more auditors, and we already talked about why that raises its own set of questions. So we found her outside of her office at the VA yesterday. We approached her. We tried to ask our questions, and she refused to say anything and slammed her car door in our face.
Wow.
And so that is the answer that she's giving every single veteran that has ever been treated at the Salisbury VA. That is the answer that she's giving the family of Charles Earnhardt, who died waiting for an appointment at the Hickory VA clinic, which is part of the Salisbury VA, who died because they failed to diagnose him with the disease, with a fatal disease.
Wow.
That is the answer that she's giving to all of the veterans who had to wait 500 days. That's the answer that she's giving to 1,300 veterans who are currently still in the backlog waiting for a radiology appointment that the Inspector General also found at the Salisbury VA. And she's slamming her car door in their face.
Well, Nick, I think that what you need to do is you need to compile a video montage of people doing that sort of thing, because I know that's part of your job is you run into people that don't want to talk, and you could probably put together quite an array of interesting footage of people not wanting to talk to you. But in all seriousness,
well, that's probably true. And look, I would prefer to sit down and talk with people, right? I don't like car doors being slammed on my face, and I don't like having to find people in parking lots. But, you know, we only go to that, we only take that measure and decide to do things like that. And it's not an ambush, by the way. People would call that an ambush. It's not an ambush because people are only ambushed when they don't know that someone is trying to ask questions of them. And this is always a last resort for us. And so, you know, we only do this when we have to, and I'd prefer we never have to, but that would require everyone being willing to be held accountable and, I don't know, do a simple thing like answer our questions.
Well, it would make me nervous if I saw you walking up the sidewalk with camera in tow. But nevertheless, can you talk to for a minute, Nick, about the news release, Duke Energy saying that they're going to start recycling coal ash at the Buckstream station. And this apparently is a resolution of action between them and the Southern Environmental Law Center.
Yeah, isn't that interesting? The Southern Environmental Law Center tells people, puts out a press release saying, we've reached a settlement deal with Duke Energy over their coal ash facilities at the Buckstream station, which is in Rowan County, and they are going to excavate all of their coal ash out of that facility, and they're either going to recycle it or they're going to move it to a lined landfill, which is functionally what the settlement is. Duke Energy puts out a statement that says, we're going to recycle all of our coal ash. It's just a great example of how PR people spin things. Yeah. And Duke has wonderful PR people. They're very good at their job. So this was a resolution that was the settlement was reached yesterday in a federal court case that the Southern Environmental Law Center was representing the Yadkin Riverkeeper and some other environmental groups suing Duke Energy, seeking to have the Buckstream Station coal ash facilities closed. The environmentalists contend that these facilities are leaking, that the groundwater is contaminated, people's nearby well water is contaminated, and this is where we saw some of the highest levels of hexavalent chromium in tests that were done of well water across the state. We have talked with one neighbor for a story we did in May who had a hexavalent chromium level of 23 parts per billion, which is astronomically higher than what North Carolina public health officials had determined to be a safe level. So this is the resolution here. This is a similar thing to what would have happened under the governor's and DEQ's classifications that they released, but earlier this year, in early May, for a while, the Buckstream Station coal ash facilities and all of Duke's facilities in North Carolina were going to have been required to be fully excavated. But then the legislature passed a law following that that requires Duke to run water to all of these neighbors and neighboring coal ash facilities with wells, but allowed Duke to just cap these facilities in place. So this is a big step for Duke and a big commitment for Duke to make. It's also a big win, the environmentalists would say.
Well, I think they both are happy to take some credit for this. You know, Nick, I've talked to people from DEQ, and correct me if you've heard anything different, but the reality is that the actual implementation of physically moving the vast amount of coal ash that's there would take years and years and years. And then there's the question of, okay, you know, we've got it in these big trucks. Now what do we do with it? Is this recycling stuff, these recycling centers, are they going to be able to, it doesn't say here in the release what they're going to recycle the coal ash into. Is this for like use in roads, or have you heard anything about what they're going to do with it?
Yeah, correct. Traditionally, coal ash actually makes wonderful, is wonderful element or whatever, compound component of concrete, of wallboard, and of road material, because coal ash is really, really strong. The problem is it's also really, really heavy. So it's time consuming and it's costly and it's very labor intensive to truck it out. So you're right. That is the biggest challenge to closing any of these facilities is the actual process of excavating coal ash facilities. And that's why, you know, 50 years ago, people decided, well, it would be safer to just put it in these ponds and put water on top of it so it can't fly away and let it sit there. The problem with that is that as it has sat there over, 50 years, and some less, but, there are coal ash facilities that are 50 years old in the state, that as the coal ash sits there, it seeps down to the water table, and it starts running into the water table. And coal ash contains elements like hexavalent chromium, like vanadium and others, selenium, that are very harmful to the environment, some elements that are very harmful to humans. And so as it enters the water table over time, because it just sinks down because it's heavy, that's a problem. And two, Duke has, as we saw from the Dan River coal ash spill, Duke has a lot of problems at some of their coal ash facilities in terms of leaks that are leaking into rivers and things like that. The Cliffside Coal Ash Pond has literally a creek running through the coal ash pond.
Wow.
That runs into the Broad River. And so, yes, frankly, I mean, this is just my opinion, but as kind of a, neither an environmentalist nor an employee of Duke Energy, excavating coal ash is time-consuming, it's costly, it's labor-intensive, you know, it subjects the neighbors to, you know, coal ash dust, which is also not a good thing. And so that does not seem like an attractive solution. It is also, to me, not an attractive solution, you know, when you consider the environmental implications of doing what Duke wants to do at all of its facilities, which is basically taking all the, sucking all the water out of its coal ash ponds and then putting many layers of dirt and other, you know, kind of caps, they call it cap in place, and leaving it there. So really there are two bad solutions. The excavating is the solution that ensures that it is no longer going to impact the environment. I think that's what the environmentalists would say, although Duke would probably say capping in place doesn't impact the environment either.
Well, certainly it's not a problem that's going to be solved today or tomorrow or next year, but hopefully this recent agreement between Duke and the Southern Environmental Law Center will be able to be a step in the right direction. I know you're we're running out of time here, but quickly I wanted to ask you two quick questions. Number one, is Charlotte geared up for any potential harm or impact of Hurricane Matthew? And number two, can you tell us now what the mood in the city is following the release of the full video by the police? It didn't seem to show a lot more than the previous videos, but what's going on in Charlotte? People worried about the hurricane, and are they feeling better about the shooting event with Mr. Scott? Or just give us a bead on the mood of the city.
Sure. The real impact that we've had from the hurricane isn't any actual weather that we might get, it seems, around here, but really the flood of evacuees that we've seen coming into the city and the surrounding area, you know, from places in South Carolina, from Charleston and elsewhere. The highways were very crowded yesterday as people come to seek safe shelter, and I think they're coming here because we're, you know, really not going to be impacted by the actual storm. So we'll see that play out. We'll see if, you know, we're on the lookout here for price gouging, what have you. So that's the impact the storm's having. The release of the video, I think, was a good step for transparency. That's something that our station and I in particular had been advocating for and working for. We were one of a number of media outlets that formed a coalition to try to evaluate next steps and push through legal channels for that video to be released. I think the family of Keith Scott has raised some questions following the full release of that video. The police chief has said he's committed to an outside independent review, which is currently being conducted by the FBI and the district attorney's office. And so I think things have definitely cooled down from the last time we talked 2 weeks ago. But I think this is going to be something that the community takes a long-term approach to waiting and seeing. And everyone's kind of had an opportunity to take one deep breath as we move into the next chapter in this post Keith Scott, you know, situation.
Well, Nick, always a pleasure. You are certainly on top of things, and we know that when we talk to you, we're going to get the very latest and the most in-depth regarding the stories that you are covering and investigating. We certainly appreciate your time. Thank you again for being our guest on What Matters in North Carolina.
Thanks a lot. Talk soon.
All right. Bye-bye. Always a pleasure to talk to our good friend Nick Ochsner, and really gets a lot done. Good guy, and we appreciate him coming on What Matters in North Carolina. So on my social media today, there's an article being posted that actually came out in October of 2015. The title says, "Leaked Audio, Clinton Says Supreme Court is Wrong on the Second Amendment." And we're going to play that audio for you and let it speak for itself.
I've already started taking on the NRA. We have got to have some support. I do not believe that the NRA represents most gun owners. They sure don't represent the majority of Americans. But they have so intimidated elected members of Congress and other legislative bodies that these people are passing the most absurd laws. The idea that you could have an open carry permit with an AK-47 over your shoulder walking up and down the aisles of a supermarket is just despicable. So I'm going to speak out. I'm going to do everything I can to rally people against this pernicious, corrupting influence of the NRA. And we're going to do whatever we can. I was proud when my husband took them out, and we were able to ban assault weapons, but he had to put a sunset on. So 10 years later, of course, you know, Bush wouldn't agree to reinstate them. We've got to go after this. And here again, the Supreme Court is wrong on the Second Amendment. And I am going to make that case every chance I get. So I will need your help on that.
Well, that audio certainly speaks for itself. And like I said, that was from a year ago. But certainly Hillary Clinton has not changed her views on the Second Amendment, on gun control, on the NRA, on American citizens who want to exercise their right to keep and bear arms. And joining us now, the host of another program you can hear on the Freedom Action Network, Matt Calder. He's the host of NC Gun Dad. Matt, welcome to the program.
Well, thanks, Mark. It's good to be here.
So when you hear somebody like Hillary Clinton or somebody else just go off like that on the Second Amendment, how does it make you feel?
Well, my first thought is that they don't really have a respect for any amendments if they're going to trash the Second Amendment. But beyond that, I realize that at the end of the day, they don't understand the Second Amendment. They don't understand 95% of what they're talking about. And we see it over and over with Senator Dianne Feinstein talking about the shoulder flippy thingy as a barrel shroud. We see it with different ones talking about ghost guns. We see that Democrats are railing against guns, mostly Democrats, honestly. I mean, there's your everyday exception. Well, but mostly Democrats railing against guns when they don't even understand them.
So we have an open carry law here in North Carolina, but I sort of tried to visualize what Hillary Clinton was describing in her little tirade there. Somebody strolling through a grocery store with an AK-47 strapped on their shoulder. I've never seen anybody in a grocery store rolling around like that. Maybe you have, I don't know, but I think her illustration is kind of over the top. Would you agree?
Definitely. And well, so we don't have an open carry law in North Carolina. It's called constitutional carry because there's no law against openly carrying a firearm.
Okay.
So there's no law, there's no permit in North Carolina to go out and carry a gun openly. Now, you still can't carry in places that you wouldn't be able to legally carry. And this does extend to rifles. I've never seen someone here in North Carolina carrying a rifle. Personally, I've never seen. I know it has happened. And I don't think it's a good idea to carry a rifle around in your back, or definitely not like in your hands or on your front, however you want to have it slung around you. I don't think it's a good idea, but also it's legal.
Well, you know, I think the point here, Matt, is that Hillary and others, when they talk about guns and gun control and the Second Amendment, it's certainly intended to engender an emotional response, to fuel people's fear, to fuel their concerns. You know, when you have these officer-involved police shooting incidents, when you have people shooting up a school or a bar, as it was in Orlando, and they tap into this part of people's brains emotionally that think, yeah, you know, if nobody had a gun, these things wouldn't be happening. But that's really not the case.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's obviously way over the top. I mean, this, you're talking about the very, 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 very rare exception to the where there's somebody who decides to walk around with a rifle, and trying to use this very rare exception, and as well using an AK-47 as the example, you know, the terrorist rifle, as the example, when in reality it's people carrying handguns on their side in a holster that most people don't even notice. And she's trying to use this scary example to demonize all of it.
So do you really believe that people are safer in a society where folks are allowed to carry guns with a concealed carry permit or openly, as you said? We don't have a law here in North Carolina, but people are allowed to do it. An example I could think of is, you know, we've heard of road rage where somebody cuts you off and you get angry and start chasing them down the road. What if you're in a restaurant and somebody, you know, bumps into you or jumps in front of you in line, and the guy's got a gun that maybe that restaurant allows people to conceal carry in there? Isn't the likelihood of that person, you know, having restaurant rage or whatever, and using that weapon, isn't there a greater threat there?
I would say no. I mean, so whenever there's a road, let's take road rage for example. Let's say that somebody cuts you off, you have road rage, you go and you run him off the road, jump out with your tire iron, beat his head in. Let's say you jump out, pull out a gun, shoot him. Let's say you jump out and hit him, stab him with a knife you have in your pocket, hit him with your lunchbox. If you're going to have an act of violence, if you're going to carry out an act of violence, you're going to carry it out with whatever you have. Now, on the other side, let's say, you know, somebody thinks I cut them off, runs me off the road, jumps out of their car with a tire iron, I pull out a handgun and I defend myself. And it was a good use of having it. I mean, and you're talking about, there's a quote, it's by Robert Heinlein. He was an American science fiction writer, but his quote was, an armed society is a polite society. And he's not wrong. He's very right that if you know there's a risk that someone, there's a chance that someone is carrying a gun, whether it's open and you see it, or you know they are, or it's concealed, if you know that possibility's there, you're less likely to do something stupid thinking there won't be a high price, because there could be.
Well, that certainly is food for thought and something that makes a lot of sense. Finally, and our guest is Matt Calder here. He's host of NC Gun Dad, which you can hear at freedomactionnetwork.com. I've been railing here on this show that our constitutional guarantees are under constant assault, particularly in the area of the First Amendment, freedom of speech, freedom of religion, but also the Second Amendment, our right as American citizens to keep and bear arms. Do you share the same concerns that I do about the assault on our rights? And it doesn't seem like people really care. How do we get people to wake up and realize that these are very real threats to our liberty as Americans?
I don't know if we can, honestly. I mean, it's been said 100,000 times, but the Second Amendment defends the rest. The Second Amendment defends your right to free speech and freedom of the press, freedom to assemble, you know, all those First Amendment rights. The Second Amendment, it defends your right against search and seizure. It defends your right against, you know, all these different rights that we have are defended by our right to bear arms, by the check, your checks and balances. The check to government power is power of the people, which is very much helped by the right to bear arms. It's not about hunting. It's not about self-defense, even at the end of the day. It's not about sport and, you know, sport shooting and clay shooting, clay pigeons. It's about defending the other rights. And people are willing to let it go, and they're only going to realize once that one's gone how quickly the other ones go further, because they're already under attack. But people aren't, they're not going to realize it. It's a very slow process. And people who are working on this are very determined and very patient. You see it in other world powers, and you see it people here at home who are intent on removing these safeguards to freedom.
Well, we certainly will do all that we can here on What Matters in North Carolina to keep people aware that these threats to our personal liberties, and First Amendment and Second Amendment rights, and the whole ball of wax are under assault by those on the left. Matt, thank you for being our guest here on What Matters in North Carolina. I encourage folks to check out NC Gun Dad as well.
Thanks for having me.
So there's Matt Calder, and he's does a great job with the NC Gun Dad show, and he also does a great job producing his show and the Free to Brew show, and also What Matters in North Carolina. We appreciate that. So as we come to the end of today's program, we've had a really cool day. I think talking with Senator Joyce Kravick was really nice because she's not been on the show before. And if you didn't listen to that, it was the very first interview that we did. And she's just really, really articulate about, you know, what it is to be a conservative and the glaring differences between conservatives and liberals. Also, Nick Oxner talking about really what is inexcusable, the way that veterans are being treated, and a report down there at the Salisbury VA Medical Center and folks manipulating data saying, oh, no, these guys are getting their appointments right away. There's no wait time. And the director there slamming the car door in Nick's face won't answer questions about these reports. And folks, you know, our veterans, good grief, you know, nobody likes to wait to get an appointment, but these folks, you know, how obvious is it? But they have bled and died in many cases, come back wounded, and they should be treated with the utmost of thanks and respect. And how often do we hear these horrendous stories about the VA? well, I can't get an appointment. I can't get to see my doctor, you know, and it shouldn't be like that. It really should not be like that at all. And so we appreciate Nick Oxner sharing with us. And then finally, we played for you the sound there of Hillary Clinton and her railing against the NRA and the Second Amendment and American citizens that enjoy the right to keep and bear arms. And there's really no excuse for that, because we have a constitution. And it seems like she and others of her ilk are determined to shred that constitution. I've posted a couple of articles at NC Capital Connection where you can read about the threats to our constitutional amendments, our rights, First Amendment, Second Amendment. I told you yesterday about a Massachusetts law that could greatly impair a minister's ability to preach right out of the Bible. And gee, First Amendment much? But these transgender laws and these gun control laws and all of these things that the militant left want to do, basically, they equate to one thing, and that is shredding, taking away, destroying, nullifying your rights, my rights as an American citizen. So those of you who are listening, and maybe you've got a very principled approach to this election, and I'm not going to vote for Hillary, and I'm not going to vote for Donald Trump. Well, if you don't vote, chances are you are helping the liberal cause that wants to take away your constitutionally guaranteed rights. So just think about that as you're patting yourself on the back for being so much better than everybody else by not voting, or by voting for a third-party candidate that has literally zero chance of winning. So you're free as an American, thank God, to vote for whoever you want to vote for. But about a year from now, when suddenly the New York Times and the Washington Post scream the big giant headlines, massive gun control legislation passed. Well, you'll be able to thank Mrs. Clinton if she is elected, and you can continue to pat yourself on the back for the way you did or did not vote, and maybe you'll just get what you asked for. I don't know. I'm not telling you who to vote for. It's not my place. That's not our purpose. But I'm just asking you to think about the consequences. And if you are a conservative and you care about your rights, then you better think long and hard. And that's all I'm going to have to say about that. Well, again, thank our guests for today. And tomorrow we have another nice show for you. We will be talking with Susan Myrick. Boy, has she stirred the pot. She uncovered some real-life examples of voter fraud. Oh, wait. The left says there is no voter fraud. Well, we'll find out the truth about that on tomorrow's show with Susan Myrick of the Civitas Institute. And also our good friend Tim Boyum will be dropping by with the latest goings on and all the news that has to do with North Carolina politics. Thank you for listening. We appreciate it. Remember, you can find What Matters in North Carolina here at the Freedom Action Network, freedomactionnetwork.com. You can also download the show, subscribe in the iTunes Store and the Google Play Store as well. Until tomorrow, we'll see you.